Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening. Welcome to Life Success Radio with Dr. Hali Mustafa, the Dream Builder. And he is on at this time. We welcome you to his exciting show. The topic for tonight is Winners Fail to Succeed and Losers Quit Pursuit. And now I bring on Dr. Hali Mustafa, the Dream Builder. Dr. Mustafa, take it away. Okay, as we wait for Dr. Mustafa, we want to go ahead and share something with you. And this is a very important part of the African-American legacy. And it is a very, very special song to all of us. It's actually the music for the called the Black National Anthem, Lift Every Voice and Sing.
Yes, good evening, everyone. I want to thank you very much. We had a little, I did at least, a technology glitch, but everything happens well. Team effort here, kind of, you know, make sure that things get taken care of. So I really appreciate our technology engineering team, and thank you for, you know, saving me an embarrassment this evening. But everything happens for a reason. So, again, I want to say to you, my name is Dr. Hali Mustafa, Haleem the Dream Builder, Doctor of Self-Esteem. And I'm welcoming everyone here this November 22nd, 2017, to Life Success Radio and another session that we're going to do to help ourselves to start helping ourselves in the way that brings us to freedom, justice, and equality. So from the womb to the tomb, we hear your voices. Life Success Radio is creating our own future paradise to move you, especially our youth, forward out of the pastime paradigm of slavery in America and around the world. Now, before we begin, I'd like you to join me in prayer, and I'm going to say it in Arabic and in English. Join me if you will. A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen. Ar-Rahmanir Rahim. Maliki Yawmiddin. Iyyaka na'budu wa iyyaka nasta'in. Ihdina siratal mustaqim. Siratal ladzina an'amta 'alayhim ghayril maghdubi 'alayhim waladdallin. Now, in English, that translation of the Arabic, which I recited, is as follows. I, or we, seek refuge with God away from the cursed devil, Satan, with the name of Allah, God, most gracious, most merciful. Praise be to Allah, God, cherisher and sustainer of all the worlds. Most gracious, most merciful, master of the day of judgment. Thee alone do we worship, and thy aid and guidance we seek. Show us the straight way, the way of those on whom thou hast bestowed thy grace, those whose portion of life achievement is not wrath, and who go not astray in their service to you. Amen. Amen. Let it be so. Now, I want to say that our sponsor for Life Success Radio this evening and over the past almost like a few months now, and it's been a very wonderful experience, is Life Success Radio sponsor is Reality Books, publisher of the American classic book, Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. Now, the author of that book is the senior great-grandson of Dr. Booker T. Washington, founder of Tuskegee Normal Institute in Alabama, more famously today known as Tuskegee University. And so the book certainly was written by his senior great-grandson, Professor Marshall Washington Cavendish Musa Abui. And the book, as I understand and read it and enjoy it, is actually not talking about a lot of past, but more so relevant solutions for today to go forward as a country, as America, as a people, as citizens, as human beings, learning to work together and carry out our civic duty and our spiritual responsibility to each other. So I would say that that book is certainly something we recommend you actually purchase and share with people you love. Again, the nice topic was mentioned earlier, and the idea of winners fail to succeed while losers quit pursuit. Now, before I get into that subject, I want to just mention that on these on Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday, Life Success Radio conducts interviews. Today we actually had an interviewee set, but a little matter occurred, and certainly I understand the holiday season or the Thanksgiving season kind of gets in the way a lot of times. It slows down a lot in this time of year, but in any event, the intention was there, and the gentleman had a little issue medically, so things happen, and we just have to keep moving on. But in terms of just getting an idea of the show, content in terms of title of the show and slogan. On Monday, the show is targeted as senior moments. Senior moments, and the slogan is Life's Real Wisdom Teachers. And on Tuesday, we have a show especially for young people under 30, and it's entitled Easy Generation. Smart Minds Making Ways to the Future. And on Wednesdays, which is like today, the show is entitled Blessed to be Blessed, and it's captioned as a slogan, Miracle Warriors Living the Dream Without Excuses. So we certainly want to let you know, stay tuned for this, and the time is normally that we come on is at the hour. Excuse me a second here. Okay, hold on here. Okay, hold on. Let's see what's going on here. A little technology issue I have to address here right quick. Okay, excellent, excellent. That would be a great thing there. Yes, that would be really good. I'm looking at something to schedule an interview in place of the one that departed. So I'm going to see if the professor might be available to interview tonight here. So let me make an inquiry and see whether or not that would work for his schedule. And just bear with me on this moment here. But either I'll just kind of wait and see if there's a response, and we'll go and do that. What I want to say to you is that tonight is like, well, we're getting ready for Thanksgiving, and I want to say something that Thanksgiving is really a wonderful season. And I want to say this in all sincerity, that the Indians, they said, blessed Thanksgiving to the pilgrims as the pilgrims landed and the Indians showed them how to survive and eat. Now, unfortunately, the pilgrims or the settlers, they said, thanks. Now give me your land and everything else. Because it's been like people have taken advantage of the Indians instead of reciprocating the things that they had given. It's been a pull away and has kind of destroyed the nation of Indians. Now, I say that because I know that there's also a problem with blacks in this country that are kind of like figuring out which way to go after getting out of slavery a long time ago, over 154 years ago, in 1864 or 65, the freedom was so-called given, but it really wasn't a total freedom, as the Constitution, 13th Amendment, still gives reference to a certain lockdown that we are still under. But the point I want to say is that Thanksgiving, we all have to give thanks for something. And for me, it's like being alive, and it's like having my own mind, and it's like the ideas that we can work on independent plans for our own freedom, justice, and equality. Now, I know that there's a lot of people who kind of don't understand how we feel. Professor, are you online, sir?
Yes, I am.
Oh, excellent, sir. I tell you, I really want to appreciate you for responding here. I had a guest that had a little matter, and so I want to, you know, interview you and let you talk a bit about, you know, who you are and what you're doing, because it's extraordinary what I've experienced with you in the year or so here, and the things that you've been actually active in. So, in introducing yourself, how would you say some of the most important things that you have come across as the senior great grandson of Booker T. Washington in holding up the family legacy? Because your great grandfather was certainly a winner, and he didn't quit. You know, so do you have any comments on that, and just kind of take it away, if you will?
Yes, thank you very much. I'm honored to be able to be on your show this evening, and I do want to start at the beginning. Actually, I was born during World War II. In fact, next week I will be 74 years old, so I was born on the 5th of December, 1943, right in the middle of the Second World War, and that is significant because I am the child not a child anymore, but I'm the offspring of one of the first black U.S. Army Air Force pilots commissioned into the U.S. Army Air Corps as a second lieutenant during the early part of America's involvement in World War II. He was commissioned in October of 1942 after having graduated from Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia, in the field of economics. And this will be important in just a few minutes when I explain his background and how it affected me and my development. But he married the granddaughter, one of the granddaughters of Booker T. Washington, who is my mother, of course. Her name was Margaret Ernestine Washington. And shortly after they were married, he was assigned to duty from Tuskegee, Alabama, where the famous Tuskegee Airmen were trained initially. He was assigned to Selfridge Field in Michigan, outside of Detroit, Michigan, for advanced training and deployment preparation to go to the war in Europe. And so, because he was on orders to get ready to leave at any time to go to catch the ship along with the other pilots and crew members of his unit, which was the 332nd Fighter Group under the leadership of then Colonel Benjamin O. Davis Jr., because they were on orders to get ready to leave to go to the war. He was unable to come and visit my mother and me when I was born, so I did not see him until the end of the war, which was almost 3 years later. But the point is that having grown up, or began my life in the home of a black, very proud officer in the U.S. Army Air Force, I began to aspire to become, like my father, a military officer. And so I took particular interest in everything military, and especially the training, or at least the parades, of the Tuskegee military cadets. Now, when I was a child, all of the men that attended Tuskegee, unless they were medically disabled, were military cadets. Some of them were being trained to become military officers, and they were in the Advanced Military Cadet Training Program, which was supervised by the U.S. Army. Others were being trained just for the purpose of having an organized disciplinary student organization. But on Sunday mornings, all of them, both the upperclassmen who were aspiring to become U.S. military officers and the other students, would be marched from a particular point on the campus, near the center of the campus, to the chapel and behind them. And this is not significant that they were behind them, but the fact is that the leaders in the parade were the members of the band, playing generally some church-related music like Onward Christian Soldiers, and following them would be the military cadet corps of males cadets, and then behind them would be all of the women that were in attendance at Tuskegee, and they also wore uniforms for this service. And so it was very impressive to me to see this order and discipline. Every Sunday I would sit on a hill, small hill, actually a slope, overlooking the main campus street where they would march from the center of the campus to the chapel. And this inspired me to want to be in the military. So as soon as I was old enough to put on a uniform, I asked my mother, begged my mother, to buy me a uniform. And it was the uniform of the Cub Scout program under the Boy Scouts of America umbrella. And I was 8 years old at that time. But even before that, my father began to train me in things military, including teaching me drill steps and also teaching me how to make my bed like a military person. And he would have inspections in my room, and I would have to make sure that he didn't find any dust on any level spot or in any corner or under the beds, because that was part of his duties as a military officer, is to inspect the rooms of the soldiers. And he knew exactly where to look, so I couldn't get away with not having the room completely clean. Now, the reason why I'm giving you that background, and I'll be finished in a minute in case you have other questions, is because later, when I was 14 years old, I entered the St. Emma Military Academy in Virginia, near Richmond, Virginia, and it was an all-black military institution that had been founded in 1895 for the military and industrial education, as well as academic educational training of the descendants of black slaves as well as American Indians. It was established by a lady who was related to the wife or widow of the man whose death we sadly commemorate on this day, President John F. Kennedy. The lady's name was Catherine Drexel. She was the stepdaughter of a lady named Emma Bouvier. So she was actually not related to her by blood, but she regarded her as her mother because Catherine Drexel's mother, had died right after childbirth. And so she never really knew her mother. So Emma Bouvier, who became the wife of Colonel Drexel, who was also known as the founder of Drexel University, married Emma Bouvier, and Emma Bouvier raised both Catherine and Louise Drexel, Louise being the sister of Catherine. Catherine was canonized as a saint in the Catholic Church a few years ago, primarily because of the great work that she did among African Americans and American Indians, founding several institutions, including Xavier University in New Orleans, as well as the school that I attended and the sister girls' school, which was about a half a mile away, named St. Francis de Sales High School. And so I graduated from the St. Emma Military Academy as the honor cadet for my class and with the rank of cadet captain in June of 1961, and went on to begin college. And shortly after beginning college, I decided that I wanted a military career, since that was basically in my blood, so to speak. And so I left college, where I was being trained to be an Air Force officer, but the pace was too slow for me, and I decided I wanted to go back into wearing the uniform full-time. And so this time, instead of going into the Air Force, I went into the Army, primarily because my training at the military academy had been Army training, and I knew that like the back of my hand, so to speak. So I was able to immediately, as we say in the Navy, from which I'm retired, I was able to hit the decks running. So I was within days promoted to the rank of acting sergeant after having begun basic training, and helped to train the rest of the soldiers that didn't have the background that I had. And I'll just kind of summarize the rest of my military experience by saying that in February of 2001, I completed 27 years of active military duty, and that was also augmented by 3 years of reserve duty, in which period half of that time I actually was in the drilling reserve, where I was basically on call, so that at any time during those months that I was in drilling status, I could have been called back into active duty. So I concluded my military service in July of 2001, having completed 30 years of active and reserve service. And now I'm in what is called the retired reserve status, where I can still be recalled in case of a national emergency or a war, which at my age I don't expect to be, but then you never know. But I'm proud of my service to the United States of America. I aspired as a child to be able to be a military professional, and I did achieve that goal. Now, in relation to the topic that you've chosen tonight, I would like to just mention that I'm very familiar with that topic because I failed many times during my 30 years in the military. I did not become a commissioned officer in the U.S. Army, primarily because I left the Army after being offered the chance to earn a commission at OCS in order to return to college. But I feel that I made the right decision because my family was very, very happy that I was back in school instead of being in Vietnam. And at that point in my life, I really want to lose the admiration of my family, who was not very happy when I enlisted at 18 years old. So they were happy when I went back to college. But I don't feel bad about that because I later received an honorary commission as a lieutenant colonel from the state of Alabama, which is my home state. And so even though I didn't ever serve in uniform as a military officer, that I'm socially and legally entitled to wear the honorary title of colonel, lieutenant colonel, and I don't do it, but I feel glad that I was able to get that type of military recognition. So I also had other challenges along the way. In fact, I'm looking at it now. I think I was 39 years old when I finally graduated from college with a bachelor's degree. And I think I was around 37 years old, somewhere in that range, when I received my first degree after many years of working, as my family can attest. Little by little, step by step, year by year, I chopped a little piece at a time on the tree of achievement of a college degree until I finally did get one, and then another, and then another, and then another, and then another, and then another. Having had some setbacks along the way, but never giving up. And so today I'm very honored and humbled to say that it's all paid off for me, because I now am a college professor of history here in Georgia for the University System of Georgia, which encompasses 35 campuses. So I teach a course each term, which is online, prefer. It's a lot easier on me physically because I don't have to stand up in the classroom for an hour at a time, basically performing for the students, which
is basically what the students expect now. And I have students from all over the state of Georgia. And so I'm very happy with the way things have turned out. But it was never an easy road. And so in closing my comments for this moment, anyway, I'm not going anywhere, but I think you may want to say something or ask other questions. The only way that a person can ever lose in a race is to quit and roll off to the sidelines. And I end by saying this. When I was in the military academy, I had a very bad habit that I am thankful I don't have any longer. I smoked cigarettes as a teenager. I grew up in an environment where that was common and accepted and even encouraged. It kind of showed that we were grown to an extent, even though I was only 16 years old. And so I participated in a 440-yard race, which I had been training for, but not under pressure. I'd played football, and, you know, I had been able to maintain my ability to run, even though I smoked. But this was a very grueling race because I never run 440 yards continuously under pressure, under stress. And when I got around to the last lap, I felt like I was going to die, literally. I felt like I had no more to give. And, of course, my lungs were weakened because of cigarette smoking. But I knew I could not quit. People were in the stands, on the sidelines, watching. And here I am struggling to come around the bend and get to the finish line. And I knew that the last thing I wanted it to be said about me is that I could not finish the race or would not finish the race. So I struggled, and I found the air from somewhere inside of my lungs to make it to the tape, the finish line, and I fell out. And I struggled to keep myself from passing out, but I finished the race. So that's been the story of my life. I've always finished the race. Sometimes I've done it under great duress, but I've always finished the race. And so I think that my best advice to any of your listeners would be, no matter when you do it, how you do it, or why you do it, in every case, finish the race. So that's all I had to say about that right now.
You know, Professor, in hearing this, a lot of this is the first time for me hearing these things, and I'm just really, you know, it takes me aback to hear the years of 1895, you know, in terms of the things that you were able to see. And coming up today, do you think that our young people need to take advantage of the military to get opportunity for themselves? Because right now there's a lot of criminal things that are going on that taking young people away from life as free people.
Well, first of all, you have two sides of the military. You have the side of the military discipline and the honor that goes with being disciplined and having the pride of working as a team to build up the legacy of a military unit and the esprit de corps that goes with working to achieve unit goals. And then you have the other side, and that is the side where people die from very grievous wounds in battle. And I would never wish for anyone to have to suffer the wounds of warfare. But the truth of the matter is that we all have to be prepared, because we do not live in an ideal world. And there will be people that will actually try to eliminate us from this earth. And we have to be able to stand up to the challenge of survival and self-preservation for ourselves and those that we love, including on a larger scale members of our community and our nation. I have been in mortal combat, and I can truthfully tell you that there's nothing in the world is as exhilarating as surviving when somebody is trying to take your life. But what happened to my enemy was not pretty, and I wouldn't wish that on anyone. It could have happened to me. It's just that I was blessed to be the victor in that particular battle. It was a hand-to-hand combat, one-on-one situation, and I won't go into the details. But the fact of the matter is that that's part of manly life, at least to be prepared for that type of experience. And yes, I do believe that every physically able male, and when I say physically able, I don't eliminate from that list those people that cannot run, jump, pass the PT test, because even in the U.S. military, when you get to be a certain age, you are exempted by age and also by physical disabilities, but that doesn't mean that you don't have to still be prepared to use whatever resources that the military feels that you can handle. You may not be able to go on an infantry combat unit exercises, but you may be assigned to answer telephones, or you may be assigned to sit up in a guard tower somewhere with an automatic rifle to protect the fort. So, yes, I think every male, and I'm not too, to be frank with you, and some people may disagree with this. If we have women that are listening, there may be some who are in the military that feel that I shouldn't say this. But I'm not really in agreement with the idea of women going into combat, although I know throughout the world, there are many armies that for years have had women in uniform who have been trained in combat. But you see, I understand something about the natural relationship between men and women. I understand that if a man is worth his salt as a man, if he sees a woman go down who is his squad mate, they could have squads in the army of 11 people. And the way the army is situated now, half of them may be females. And a good man, if he sees a woman go down, he's going to try to protect her from further injury, dragging her off into a place where it's safe. Or he's going to even risk his life to save her life. The problem with that, and that's just because we're built that way. We should have the desire to protect women. But the problem with that is that a soldier is trained to keep on with the mission, even if his buddy goes down, the mission be spared so that he can take care of his buddy, who may be his best friend for those years that they're together. And even if he sees that that person could be saved by applying a tourniquet or by doing something right there on the spot, if the lieutenant says, everybody proceed forward and we'll call the medics to come and try to save this person, you can't hold back. You have to keep moving forward, even though you know that the medics may not get there in enough time to save your buddy. But the natural tendency would be to try to keep that woman from being harmed further just because we feel that she needs our support and our protection. I think for the men, I think every single man in the United States should serve at least 2 or 3 years in uniform in the military, go through basic training, advanced training to be trained in some particular military-related skill, and be put on a post somewhere to learn how to fulfill the necessary duties assigned to that post. I think that should be part of the law. Now, we do have a law called Selective Service, but the Selective Service law basically says that only if the president feels that we need to have people get in the military will people have to go. But everybody 18 years old, every male, not females yet, but every male is supposed to register under the current law for the draft. So we'll have a list of the addresses of people. But to answer your question directly, I think the military should be obligatory for every single male, but not for the females. That's my feeling.
Yes, sir. I was thinking, and I appreciate that insight there. My thought went to the idea of the real threats of a possible attack of this country by little people who want to make a big name for themselves. And the idea of attack is not something that is improbable. Look like today it's a whole lot of more talk and a lot of, you might say saber rattling. Now, do you have any thoughts that this stuff can jump off into a real war in this day and time right now?
I think it's an absolute what we would call not only probability or possibility, but inevitability. No nation that I know of, being a historian, except the United States, that has never been attacked on its home territory. What do you think the chances are of the United States forever and ever being exempted from what has happened throughout human history? And if someone thinks that the United States is exempt, why? Okay, now, let me just say this right quick. While some people might, the United States is going to be perpetually and eternally exempt from being attacked, and I'm not counting 9/11, although that was an attack, but I'm not just talking about that isolated. I'm talking about a full-fledged attack like what happened at Pearl Harbor, which wasn't on the mainland of the U.S. Some people would say because God has divinely protected America. But if you look at the scriptures of God, God only promises to protect those that are obedient to his will. And he outlines in great detail in all of the scriptures of the major religions in America, and that doesn't just include Abrahamic religions, but even Eastern religions such as Buddhism and other religions. God only promises to protect those that serve him. So one must ask the question, and I'll make this short, is America guilty of not serving God, and how and why? Or is America actually a good example of being a servant of God, and how and where? So look at the history of this country and compare what this country has on its record with the things that God has said he requires a nation to have as its character or to do in order to be receiving its blessings. And you ask the question for yourself. I'm not going to say I want people to think about this, but the truth of the matter is that the direction that America decided to take over 400 years ago to exploit human beings from Africa and to designate them as not being creatures of God that were created to enjoy the same rights as other people that are human beings, but to be put in a category of being subhuman, which they had never been considered subhuman before they came to America. In fact, they were leaders wherever they went. If a righteous black man, and I say righteous, went to China, inevitably he became a leader in China. If a righteous black man even went to England, he became a leader in England. If a righteous black man went to the South Pacific, he became a leader in the South Pacific. It was only when these righteous people, who weren't guilty of anything except being black or African from the dark part of Africa, when they came to America, they were denigrated and said they weren't even humans. Is that justice? So that's one check mark against America right there. Then after keeping these people in bondage for over 250 years, and then saying for political reasons and only for political reasons that they were free, and then still treating them the same way as they've been treated before, that's another check mark, because they lied. The people that said that the black people were free lied. They didn't never intend to free the black people. And now you have a situation where just here recently, the government investigative bureau has decided that if you even go around promoting the idea of being black, like you used to say, we said back in the 70s, black is beautiful. I'm a proud black man. I'm black and I'm proud. Once you start going around promoting that concept now, you become a target. You get on the radar. People are going to be listening to everything you say, because they feel if you really are real serious about that, then you might become angry when you see other black people being mistreated by whoever, law enforcement, social services, and they feel that you won't be able to control your anger, because they know how long this has been building up, and that you'll explode and you'll do something like you've seen white people do recently. We haven't been doing that kind of thing. The only time we've had something like that happen was about 8 years ago, maybe 10 years ago, when this brother named, unfortunately his name was Muhammad, John Muhammad, decided to pick off people from different places because he was a nut. The man was insane. But after all of these times of black people being abused, except maybe in a few isolated cases, you've never seen somebody go into a school building or a church with the intention of killing everybody in there. Now, I will say there was this guy in Atlanta named Wayne Williams that went into a church and killed some people. You know, the brother who killed Martin Luther King's mother in church. But we've never seen any mass killing. That man said he meant to kill everybody in that church. We've seen these white boys and grown up white men go in schools with intent of killing everybody in the school. That's not our character. So they should not be looking at us and looking at us as potential serial murder terrorists, because we haven't done that in the whole 400 years when we had plenty of opportunities. Even when Nat Turner went on his rampage, and they don't want to tell you this, he did spare some people. He didn't kill everybody. He mainly attacked those people whose own slaves said they deserved to be killed because of what they had done to those slaves. And he let those slaves who were the victims of those people do most of the killing of those people on those plantations. But even so, there was less than 50 people, I believe, that got killed. So we are not the people that should be given the bullseye on us just because we stand up and say we're proud to be black. So when you have people treating other people unjustly like that, you can expect that down the road, God is going to do something to let people know you just can't do that. Because we were told when I was a boy And I'm using the language that I was taught. God don't like ugly. We know that's not correct English, but that's the way we say God don't like ugly. And he's going to do something about it. Unfortunately, it's something most Americans don't believe is going to happen. And I don't like the idea of seeing it happen, but something's got to change. Anyway, I see we're reaching the end of your hour, and I wish we had set it up to have more time. And I don't know at this late, you know, hour if we can actually do anything about that. I really don't know if it's possible to change it, to extend it, you know, at this point since it's already been set up.
Yes, sir. I'm going to say to you, you have very much insight perspective as a person who's spiritually conscious, and you've seen through your great-grandfather's eyes the kind of pain that people go through. And in today, I mean, that pain is so obvious that when I see black people, I feel really sad for us. But it's nothing that we want to go and hurt anybody, because now we look at America and there's a lot of poor white people that are very sad too from the economic exclusion from them. So I think it's a classism situation as opposed to a racism situation. That's my perspective as I look at America today, sir.
Well, you could be correct about that, but I don't think you can discount the fact that this whole thing was about race from the beginning. You see, it's important, and I was hoping that possibly we would find a way we could, you know, extend the time, but I'm looking and I don't see how we can do that, unfortunately. So that means we're going to be running out of time real soon. So let me just say this right quick. This whole idea of black enslavement started off with the idea, it goes back several thousand years, of black inferiority, which it's not true that black people are inferior, but this was promoted as a religious concept that what we were told as a child, actually, it was a little jingle we used to say. I didn't believe it, but we said it. If you're white, you're right. If you're black, get back. If you're yellow, that's mellow. But if you're brown, you can stick around. But the whole idea is that you go to the back of the line if you're black. And this just didn't start when I was a boy growing up in Alabama, where we used to say that because we had been told that. This started thousands of years ago. This whole concept of white supremacy started thousands of years ago. And if you want to read about it, there's a book called The History of White People by Dr. Nell Poynter. Is it Painter? I think it's Painter. You can get it on Amazon. Amazon.com, and it'll tell you this whole history of how white people came up with this concept that they were supposed to be inherently superior to everybody that was not white or Caucasian or whatever you want to call that. And they made up this myth, and they promoted it all over the world so that they could rule over the world for 6,000 years, but their time ended in 1914, according to the teaching of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, and also, believe it or not, I think his name was Joseph Rutherford, one of the founders of the Jehovah Witness. He also said to the white people that their time ended in 1914. And we're living on borrowed time. And as we get ready to close, I'll just say that Elijah Muhammad said the only reason why the white people have been given this extra time is to wake up the dark people of the world to the reality that they are not supposed to be ruled by these newcomers to humanity, these white people, who are really albinos, who came out of, through a process of genetic mutation, the black people, many, many centuries ago. As a matter of fact, Honorable Elijah Muhammad said 6,000 years ago, black people have a record of being on this earth millions of years. But through a long process of genetic mutation, then this race called white people came along, and because they were inferior and in the minority, then they figured they had to do something to give themselves a running start or half a chance to survive, and so they came up with this idea of white supremacy, and we're still suffering from that today.
Well, this is powerful, sir. I know we've got to like 2 minutes left here, so I want to certainly thank you for making yourself available here on this very short notice, and you spoke words of truth, and it's like, okay, we have to have a follow-up on this at some point in the future, sir.
Well, sure, I'd be happy to, you know, just let me know, and I'd be happy to come back on your show and contribute whatever I can to your show.
Wonderful, wonderful. So I want to take these last 2 minutes, sir, and just kind of go through a couple of comments here about Life Success Radio, if I could. And so thank you very much. And so here at Life Success Radio, we are sponsored by Booker T, by Reality Books, and publisher of the Booker T. Washington and the Black Revolution. And I want to say that this is a situation that we all as human beings have to work on in order to save our planet Earth and save the young people. So in the last few seconds that we have, I want to say thank you all, and please tune in future shows, Life Success Radio, and enjoy the turkey. Don't eat too much, but enjoy it, and enjoy your family relationships, because life is short. We never know how long we're going to be here. So I say to you in the closing comments, as I say, assalamu alaikum, may God's peace and blessings be with you all.